She's already completed 2 of 7 stops across the state, giving talks about the moon and other satellites and Joliet and near-Earth objects in Dwight. And she speaks tonight at the Normal Public Library about the Kuiper Belt, Oort Cloud, and Pluto. More stops and talks are planned as the galaxy ride continues to St. Louis. Dr. Walkowicz, thanks for joining us on Sound Ideas.
Well, thank you so much for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
What are your questions about space or the solar system, the Kepler telescope and its mission, or this science roadshow on a bike? Give us a call at 309-438-8910. Let's start with Pluto, still in the news because of the New Horizons flyby. What caught your attention about this dwarf planet, and what will you tell people at the Normal Public Library about this former planet?
Well, I think we're in a really interesting moment with Pluto because, you know, for many years, the best images that we had of Pluto, the ones taken by the Hubble Space Telescope, it still sort of looked like a mushy pea. So we knew that it was this outer icy body of our solar system, but we really didn't know very much about the planet itself, or the dwarf planet, as we now call it. So what we're seeing with the New Horizons mission is almost like if you had a distant relative that you had never actually seen an image of, and now you're actually able to see their face for the first time. So the surface of Pluto is covered with surprising features, giant icy mountains, signs of geological activity that we expected would have been long since gone on Pluto. And so I think that these images are just the tip of the iceberg in a series of new discoveries about this world.
What do you think is driving that geological activity? Because it's too far from the sun for the heat of the sun to have anything to do with that, probably. So is it magnetic fields? What is it?
Well, usually what drives geological activity in planets and moons is one of two things. Either, in the case of our own Earth, we have a molten core that's left over from the heat of our planet forming and also from radioactive decay in its core. And that's what gives us our melty center and what gives us volcanoes. In some of the other worlds in our solar system, Jupiter's moon Io, for example, which is the most volcanically active place in the entire solar system. In Io's case, it's actually being kneaded like a ball of dough by Jupiter's gravity. We call it tidal forces. Now, in Pluto's case, it's really kind of a mystery because Pluto is very, very small. We would expect it to have completely cooled off and not have geological activity anymore. And it doesn't have any way of being tidally kneaded by those gravitational forces. So we're not really sure what causes the geological activity on Pluto. It's still a mystery.
You're also speaking about the Oort cloud tonight. This is hypothetical. It's unobservable, the Oort cloud?
Well, the Oort cloud is not unobservable in the sense that most of the comets we know of come from the Oort cloud. So the Oort cloud, in some sense, comes to visit us in the inner portions of the solar system when we see comets. But it's very difficult to study both that and the Kuiper Belt, the home of Pluto, because all of these worlds are so very cool and they're so very far away. If you were out at that distance, the sun would just look like a particularly bright star in the sky, not like the disk that we see it here on Earth. And so it's very difficult to study things that are so far and so cool.
So your ride is organized, your bicycle ride across the state is organized in a way that makes Chicago the Earth and St. Louis the Andromeda Galaxy, is that right?
That is correct.
So Bloomington Normal is in the area of Pluto and the Oort cloud?
Yes, and we believe that the Oort cloud has quite a large extent, so it goes out to many tens of thousands of AU, but so we're right in the middle of that at the moment. So we're encompassing all of the outer portions of our solar system in this program.
So space is aptly named because there's so much of it. Do you think people understand the vast distances involved in even just between here and Pluto?
You know, sometimes I think I don't even understand the vast distances involved. As an astronomer, you sort of grapple on a day-to-day basis with these issues of scale where we talk about cosmic distance, but we don't really have as humans any way of experiencing that. And so one of the most difficult things, I think, to understand is the vast distances between us and even other worlds in our solar system. To give you some sense of perspective, the Voyager spacecrafts were launched in the 70s, and Voyager 2 is the fastest human-made object ever. 38,000 miles per hour it travels. Now, Voyager 2 was launched in the 70s and only really got to the edge of the solar system within the past couple of years. So think about that for a moment. The fastest thing we've ever launched has taken this long to get there. Even the New Horizons mission took 10 years to get to Pluto.
I referenced light years earlier. When you're peering through a telescope, you're actually looking back into time. Tell me about the light you're seeing from some common objects in space and how old that light is.
Well, for example, I kind of like to think about the fact that the light from the sun is 8.5 minutes year old. So when we talk about light years, we're really talking about a distance. It's how far light travels in a year. And so our sun is 8 light minutes away, or 150 million kilometers, 93 million miles. So when we look back in time into the depth of space, the nearest stars are maybe a few years old, the light that we receive. Most of the stars that we know planets around, other solar systems, tend to be about 1,000 light years-ish away from us, just by virtue of where we've looked. And then the Andromeda Galaxy, which is actually visible on, some nights if you're in a very dark place. Andromeda is 2.5 million light years away, which I'm very pleased to say I don't have to bike.
So we only know what that galaxy looks like 2.5 million years ago. We don't actually know what it looks like today if you're there.
True. The thing about galaxies is that they evolve over very, very long periods of time, so over billions of years. So a lot of times when people ask me about the time that light takes to travel and looking back in space, there's this notion that, for example, especially with planets around other stars, they say, well, what if that solar system's not there anymore? But the thing is that if you're looking back 1,000 years in time, sure, things might have changed on that planet, but stars evolve over millions and billions of years. And so chances are the thing you're seeing is still there, and it's probably not that different from what you're observing now.
309-438-8910. Dr. Lucianne Walkowicz is an astronomer with Chicago's Adler Planetarium and a TED Senior Fellow. She's also in the middle of a 300-mile bike ride designed to bring some perspective to the universe. You're on the Kepler Space Telescope Working Science Group. Kepler is looking for Earth-like objects. What are you doing as part of this group?
Well, so Kepler launched back in 2009, and its initial mission was to figure out a relatively simple question, which is sort of amazing that we haven't been able to do this until the past couple of years. How common are planets the size of Earth around stars that are like our sun, and specifically around stars like our sun at a distance where they get enough energy from the star that they could be the right temperature to have liquid water on their surface?
Commonly known as the Goldilocks zone?
Goldilocks zone, or the habitable zone.
Sure.
So not too hot, not too cold, just like Goldilocks's porridge. So Kepler essentially looked at this one part of space, this one little patch of the sky about the size of your palm held out at arm's length, just between the constellations of Cygnus and Lyra. And it counted up all the planets that it could find in that part of the sky and used that to extrapolate over how many planets there were in the rest of the galaxy. Now, for my own part of that, I actually work on how stars affect whether planets can be good or bad places for life. So it's not just a matter of how much light you get from the star, but it's also the quality of light. Is it low energy or is it high energy? So I specifically study what are called stellar flares. So many people may have heard of solar flares that happen on our sun. They cause the aurora borealis, for example. And these events happen on other stars as well. And they shower their planets with high energy particles, ultraviolet and X-ray radiation. And that changes the chemistry of the planet that's around them and can also create either hospitable or inhospitable environments for life to exist on those planets.
I have more questions about the Kepler Space Telescope and what you're doing with that. Let's go to the phones now, though. We have a question from Julia who has a question about the bike ride. Julia, you're on the air.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Hi, nice to talk to you.
So I went to school in St. Louis and live in Chicago and have done the drive from Chicago to St. Louis many, many times over the past few years. And I also love biking, and I'm very curious about the actual logistics of the bike ride. And I think it makes a whole lot of sense because sometimes the car ride feels very long, but I imagine the bike ride, you mentally like moving through space.
Yeah, I think that part of the motivation for doing this on a bike is not just the fun of doing it on a bike. It's also that bikes, I think, are metaphorically wonderful for being related to exploration. They're faster than walking. You cover more ground, but you can still appreciate the things around you. And it has been thus far an absolutely beautiful bike ride. So the logistics, actually, the League of Illinois Bicyclists has a wonderful resource online. If you literally just Google bike from Chicago to St. Louis, you will end up on their website, and they have a wonderful route that has very specific cues for cycling. It's mostly on side streets and community bike paths when possible. And it's very, very well documented. There's even links to GPS files if you want to be technological about it. And so it actually has made the ride extremely easy so far, and really wonderful because you get off of the interstate, of course, like when you're on a car. Anyone who says that there's nothing to look at the Midwest just needs to get off the interstate for a little while.
Julia, if this ride were to be made public, would this be something you might participate in?
It'd be something I'd think about. It's a little long for a biker of my experience level, but it definitely seems interesting.
Okay, Julia, thanks for your call. You can join Julia with your phone call at 309-438-8910. Let's get back to Kepler looking for Earth-like planets. You're not actually seeing the planets. You're really extrapolating data. Isn't that correct?
Yeah, it's an interesting thing about the search for planets around other stars is that the planets themselves are literally billions of times fainter than the star. And so the study of extrasolar planets or planets in other solar systems around these other stars is very much the study of stars themselves. The methods that we've had thus far are really observations of the stars. So there's one called the wobble method or radial velocities, where you look for what we call the reflex motion or the wiggle of the star as the planet tugs on it with its gravity. Now, the method that Kepler uses is called the transit method, where we look for systems where the planet passes between us and the star, casting a shadow just for a moment. It blocks a little bit of that starlight from getting to us and makes the star appear fainter. Now, in recent years, very, very recently, we're talking the past few years, we've now increased our ability to use what's called direct imaging, where we actually detect light from the planet itself. And so you'll start to hear more and more about that. There's a variety of different ways of doing that. Most of them just rely on blocking out the light from the star, in the same way that if somebody was shining a flashlight at you directly and you wanted to see the face of the person, you would hold up your hand and you would block that light. Similar idea, a little bit more complicated than holding your hand up.
How much do we know about Kepler 542b? And how were we able to learn how much? It's one of the most Earth-like planets out there. And how are we actually able to learn everything we know about that planet? Is it because we can see the light? Are we extrapolating data from the light?
No. So in the case of all of the planets that are discovered by Kepler, what we get is what we call a transit light curve, which is just how bright the star is with time. So we look for those little dips in the light. The size of the dip has to do with how big the planet is. So in the same way that if a very large person walked in front of the movie screen at the movie theater, they would block more of the screen versus a small person would block a little bit. What we get out of the dip in the light and how much fainter the star becomes is just the size of the planet. Now, when we watch that planet go around, we look for that dip to occur again and again that tells us something that is orbiting the star. The length of that time lapse between the dips is the length of the planet's year, which is related to how far away the planet orbits from its star via Kepler's laws, which is why the telescope is called Kepler.
So go ahead.
So what we get is size and distance away from the parent star. Sometimes if we use auxiliary data, we can get a mass. But generally speaking, we use size and the distance away from the star to extrapolate what we know about the planet.
So we don't know if there's actually water on the planets. We don't know if it's arid or if it's covered in jungle. We just don't know. And the artist representations of these planets are just best guesses.
Yeah, I would say that the artist representations of potentially habitable worlds represent the hopes of astronomers, and I would say the public as well, that we hope to find something that is similar to Earth. But within our own solar system, actually, I think Venus and Earth as sort of the twin sisters of the solar system are a great lesson. So Venus is about the same size as Earth, a little bit closer to its parent star, our sun. So if we were to discover something like Venus, we would say, oh, it's probably hot there. But we would never know that the surface of Venus is like 800 degrees. And the reason for that is that it has this very, very thick atmosphere that creates what we call a runaway greenhouse. And so Venus, there's a reason that you hear about Mars rovers and not Venus rovers. It's a very inhospitable environment. But we wouldn't necessarily know that if we saw Venus remotely. And so over the next couple of years, you'll hear about future missions that will be able to characterize what the atmospheres of these planets will be made up of.
What's your question about space? Dr. Lucy Ann Wachowicz will answer that at 309-438-8910. What I find surprising about Kepler is how many planets this mission is discovering in such a minuscule section of space. Can you talk about the breadth and depth of Kepler's vision?
Sure. So as I mentioned a little bit earlier on the show, Kepler just looks at this one little patch of the sky between the constellations of Cygnus and Lyra. It's about the size of your palm held out at arm's length. Now, if you are at home or somewhere and doing that experiment of holding up your palm against the sky, you'll see that that's a very, very small patch of sky. Now, what makes Kepler so efficient is that it takes very, very precise measurements of how bright stars are with time. And the reason that that's important is that it's able to see very, very small changes, very small dimmings of the star due to planets passing in front of their face. And the reason it only looks at that one patch of sky is that, first of all, these planetary transits, these little dips in the light, happen over just a couple of hours, and they don't recur again for maybe years. So you don't want to look away from where you're trying to find planets if you want to catch a very relatively rare event that's short-lived. Now, the reason that it only looks at this one patch, aside from being able to stare at it, is that that patch isn't particularly special. It's got enough stars that we can find, you know, lots of targets to look at, but it doesn't have so many stars that it's too crowded to tell them apart. But other than that, it's not particularly special, so it stands in for the entire rest of the galaxy. So by counting up the number of planets that we find, how big they are, percentage-wise, what kind of stars we find them around and where they occur in their own solar systems, we can use that to extrapolate how many planets we expect in the galaxy, which we expect now to be billions. And more importantly, perhaps, that in fact, planets that are small and potentially rocky like Earth, Venus, Mars are the most common kind of planet in the galaxy.
So the Fermi paradox is the apparent contradiction between the high estimates of the probability of the existence of extraterrestrial civilizations and the lack of evidence for such civilizations. Can Kepler actually help find life?
Kepler can't find life. It can find the real estate for life. So what we know at this point is that there's lots and lots of possible places to look for potentially habitable worlds and potentially inhabited worlds. The Fermi paradox has, I think, a lot packed into it because, of course, to find signs of life, we not only have to be able to sample these planets remotely, figure out what their atmospheres are made up of, which is the primary way that we would look for life in the universe, but we also fold in things like, you know, would spaceships come here or would we see, you know, signals, Morse code across the galaxy? And that folds in a whole lot of ideas about, you know, how easy it is to actually master space travel. Also space travel as something that's culturally important. So in order to actually travel to space, no matter what, even if you have the technology, it takes a lot of resources to do that. And so you have to have thought as a civilization, you have to think that that's valuable to do.
Yeah, we touched on this a moment ago. We can't get to those planets, at least in our generation, or maybe in multiple generations, we could get to those planets with our current propulsion systems. The light you're looking at is very, very old. The planet or the solar system could be gone. So what's the utility in actually doing this?
Well, I think we're answering a very fundamental question that is both scientific and human, which is, what is the context of Earth in the universe? To put it simply, are we alone? And I think that that's an interesting question to answer no matter what. Even if we weren't looking outside our own solar system, I think that if we were able to find signs of past life on, or even current life on one of the other planets of our own solar system, we would have an amazing fundamental test of, you know, how did evolution happen? What are the origins of life? Does life spread throughout the galaxy? Does it have a common origin, or does it grow up independently? These are fundamental questions about biology that we can't answer right now because we only have one example of an inhabited world. And so I think that there's an intrinsic interest amongst both scientists and people at large in figuring out, you know, whether we are the only example of an inhabited world.
What's your question about space? Dr. Lucienne Walkowicz will answer it at 309-438-8910. With Kepler, you're looking at other suns. What about our sun? We know that its light allows life on Earth, but what about some of the dangers presented by this star and our preparation for what the sun could send our way? We talked about stellar and solar flares.
Sure. So we do have these events called solar flares that are essentially these massive snapping of the sun's magnetic field. If you go on YouTube, you can actually look up the Solar Dynamics Observatory channel and watch some of these things happen. They're really beautiful to watch. They're occasionally dangerous for Earth in the fact that sometimes our sun sends blasts of ultraviolet and X-ray radiation out into space, and it also sends out energetic particles. Now, for the most part here on Earth, we're actually protected by the fact that our own planet has a magnetic field that acts as a kind of shark cage that spirals those energetic particles down along the poles, where their primary effect is to spiral down. They cause our atmosphere to glow, and that's what causes the northern and southern lights. Now, occasionally, if we have a very big solar flare, part of the problem can be that that induces currents in our existing infrastructure, and that can create blackouts, for example, so you can overload power stations. Now, obviously, we're an increasingly technologically capable and dependent society, and so having access to our electrical grid is pretty important. Unfortunately, in the U.S., a lot of our electrical grid our infrastructure is pretty old, and we don't have the most modern safety catches that we could.
So we're vulnerable and should do more.
We're definitely vulnerable. We're actually protected to a certain extent by the fact that the sun has a cycle to it. So every 11 years, the sun goes from having a maximum amount of these solar flares to having a minimum amount of solar flares. So we're actually in a decreasing time of solar activity. So we sort of have like a decade and a half at least until the sun is back at its maximum. That doesn't mean that there can't be any solar flares, but it does mean that they're far less common during that time.
Let's stay in our solar system for a moment. A big budget movie with Matt Damon is in the wings. The Martian will get an October release. Here's an excerpt from the trailer.
This will come as quite a shock to my crewmates, and to NASA, and to the entire world. But I'm still alive. Surprise. Here's the rub. It's gonna be 4 years for another mission to reach me. And I'm in a hab designed to last 31 days. So I gotta make water and grow food on a planet where nothing grows. But if I can't figure out a way to make contact with NASA, then none of this matters anyway.
So that's an excerpt of the preview of The Martian, starring Matt Damon, among others. It opens October 2nd. Is Mars an opportunity or a pipe dream in terms of human habitation, do you think?
I would say it's definitely an opportunity. It's definitely an interesting thing for us as a spacefaring civilization to try and go and actually live on another world.
Does it foster unrealistic expectations about Mars and where we can live off our own planet and how we have to take care of this planet?
I would say that the unrealistic expectation is that Mars represents some sort of second chance for humanity. I mean, Mars and colonizing Mars, I think, would be very interesting to do from the standpoint of learning about perhaps the past habitable environment of Mars. We do believe that Mars had liquid water on its surface in the past now, and we could learn a lot about potentially the origins of life, or at least just the future of planets, by going there and actually being able to be humans on the surface as opposed to robots. However, Mars is a very, very unpleasant environment, a very hostile environment. Here on Earth, you know, we have a lot of resources that I think we take for granted. And, you know, when we talk about terraforming Mars, well, you know, think about a life where you never experience wind, like you never can go outside without a spacesuit on. The wonderful thing about our planet is that we have all of these resources, and, you know, Mars is just probably never going to be Earth 2.0. And so it's very important, especially for becoming a spacefaring civilization, for us to preserve this planet, because it really is our home base for everything that we want to do.
Dr. Wachowicz, thanks for your time today. Your next stop is in Lincoln.
That is correct.
And you're headed all the way to Chicago. It's a 300-mile bike ride to bring some perspective to the vast distances in our own universe and talk about science and the solar system and beyond.
Well, and we'll be at the Normal Public Library tonight, and the Illinois State Planetarium will be having a show to complement just following our event at 7:15.
Your talk tonight is at 5 p.m., and in Lincoln, you'll talk about Alpha Centauri and Proxima Centauri.
Yes, our nearest stars. And tonight, we'll also have lots of demonstrations, so it won't just be me talking. It'll be for people to bring their questions that they might have about the universe.
Thanks for joining us on Sound Ideas. I appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.